The last 10 minutes are reserved for those who feel they may drink and haven't had the chance to share. Now to share his experience, strength, and hope with us, we have AC.
Hi, I'm AC. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very, very happy to be here tonight. Legal's been a really important meeting to me. There's three meetings in New York that have really, you know, I've been here for, I'll celebrate 13 years in March, hopefully. And you guys have been a big part of that. But this meeting and the NYU meeting, the midday meeting out in Brooklyn. But how I got involved in the Never Had a Legal Meeting was through my sponsor. My sponsor insisted that him and I go to one meeting a week together, and that I have a home group, and that I have a commitment at that home group. And I guess that this sponsor in particular, I got him when I was really kind of going through a bottom in sobriety. And I think it's important to talk about that staying sober doesn't, you're going to get your pink cloud, and things are going to change, and they're going to change for the better. But bad things will also happen. But what changes is how we respond to them. And I was kind of going through a bottom in sobriety, and I knew that in order, my desire to drink and to use has pretty much been relieved for the most part. But the desire to destroy myself has still always been there. And when I was going through this bottom in particular, the amount of self-hatred I had really was very self-destructive. And I think that I probably would have, you know, I was probably contemplating suicide more than I was contemplating drinking, which to me they're the same thing. If I drink or if I use, I think I'm as good as dead within a week to a year, you know, realistically. And so I knew what was going to make things better for me was working my program, because that's what's always worked before. So I got a new sponsor, and he was a bit of a ball breaker, which is what I needed, you know. Like, I needed someone to kick my ass in the line. And he said, you're going to come to this meeting every week. It's Never Had a Legal, and you're going to get a commitment there, and that's going to be your home group. And so when we had the business meeting, he promptly nominated me to clean the toilets. Not once, but twice. So I've had toilet duty at this meeting twice. And then after that, he nominated me for passing the mic, which I loved. Like, I felt like I was like the prom king or something. I was like, I'm not cleaning toilets, I'm passing the mic. And so when I got a sponsee here, I insisted he clean the toilets as well. So I feel like I've got this long lineage of janitorial services with legal. This meeting has saved my ass a lot, and I'm very grateful for this meeting. And a little bit about my story: I grew up in the suburbs of Pennsylvania. The house that I grew up in, my parents were entrepreneurs, and in hindsight, I've actually kind of started to realize that my parents are actually very creative people, although it was in an entrepreneurial way rather than artistic way. It's still creative, though. And they had two businesses. One was a newspaper, and one was an ambulance business. And between those two things, there's a lot of chaos in our house. And you couple that with my father's alcoholism. And, you know, just, to, I mean, to put it quickly and everything, like, you know, as kids, we're kind of left to fend for ourselves and unsupervised. And I think from that, I got a good imagination, because I wasn't really a bad kid. In fact, it was a bit more the opposite. It was a bit more the people-pleasing. About the time I turned 13, I want to say, somewhere around there, my dad got sober. And the thing that was really interesting with my dad was that he used to just drink at night. So I really don't have any memories of a drunk, abusive dad. There's nothing like that. It was just, he just wasn't there, you know. So he sobered up, and we used to go to a meeting where they had an AA meeting and an Alateen meeting and an Al-Anon meeting. So the whole family could go. It was like a TV dinner of recovery. And from that, you know, that was the only time I really remember my family ever being normal and peaceful and loving. Not that my family wasn't loving, but I mean in kind of that ideal way that we'd all would like our families to have been or be. And so it was like that for a couple of years, and then my dad stopped going to meetings. And to my knowledge, he hasn't drank again since, but he stopped going to meetings. And when he stopped going to meetings, it really, everything just started to crumble again. Whether, you know, in my opinion, there's a very clear-cut correlation between those things. And so when it did start to crumble, then, you know, everybody really, my older sister, she had moved out, my mom left, my younger sister went with my mom, and then it was me and my dad. And that's when I started to drink. And so this is like around the time I was 16 or 17, which, considering my friends, that was a little late. And I just remember the very, very first time I drank, it was a friend's house, and it was just a sleepover. And we drank Wild Turkey, and I remember that because it was in this porcelain container that was shaped like a turkey. You just took its head off. And we mixed it with Kool-Aid, and that tasted like shit. And that, like, we were just like trying to figure out things to mix it with. But I just remember that warm feeling coming down into my chest and just feeling like I'm all right. And we just started like running around the neighborhood, just like running in circles and just screaming, and you know, nothing bad really happened. And that kind of made it easier to do it again, you know? So, and of course, you know, I remember getting these pamphlets when I was a kid, the It'll Never Happen to Me pamphlet. I don't know, I guess some of you guys know that one, but like at Alateen, they used to give us these pamphlets, and they look just like the ones that the Jesus freaks hand out. And it's like, you know, like a kid on the front going, you know, it'll never happen to me. And I remember just like thinking how stupid they were, and thinking it'll never happen to me. And so I, you know, if I'm really honest about it, like I think that I probably, you know, had it under control for maybe a year, and that was probably just because of the inaccessibility to it. But you know, alcohol's not hard to find. You know, I mean, neither are drugs. Like you can find whatever you want. And so it wasn't, my senior year was when it really picked up steam, and I was basically unsupervised. I was living with my dad, but my dad was kind of living his new bachelor life, and he was really never around. So I could do whatever I want. We would just skip school, have parties at my house, and yeah, that's when it was really a lot of fun, and it was really taking off. I think it's important for people to hear sometimes too, you know. My drinking was fun till it wasn't. You know, I had a lot of good times drinking and doing drugs, and I don't regret those times, but because that makes me who I am today, you know. It's not that I want to do it again, because if I did those things again, I wouldn't have the same results. But, you know, all the time, it was in the back of my head, you know, going, it's happening to you, it's happening to you. And it's like, no, it's not. And I just was always into creative things, and I have found that being a creative person can be a great veil for your disease and for being active in alcoholism or drug addiction. So, for example, by the time I graduated, I pissed away school. You know, I went to college for about 6 months, and it didn't work. You know, and it was going to school, like, it really is unfortunate, because it was a great program, and I really, man, I wish I had the time and money to take that program again, and maybe I will, but, yeah, I mean, I blew it. 6 months, I just partied it away, and I just continued that momentum, under the guise of being a musician. You know, it was like, I wouldn't show up for work, I wouldn't show up for anything. That's actually it. I didn't show up for anything, whether it was my family or whether it was jobs or school or myself or my family. I just didn't show up. And it was always like, well, I'm playing music, I got a gig, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And it always seemed like it was like a legitimate excuse to everybody, you know? Like, well, I didn't make it to work the next day because I had a show. But after the show, I considered to get completely plowed till 4 in the morning. So the show may have been done at 11. I could have gone home and been in bed by midnight, gotten up and gone to work. But I didn't, you know? And that was my disguise, you know? And it worked for a really, really long time. And then I had a situation happen where... And I knew I was running out of steam. I knew I was kind of getting to the end of my rope with my partying. I couldn't write music anymore. I wasn't being as creative as I normally was, you know. And I was always a beer drinker, and it was always keeping... I'd always have a six-pack in the fridge that I'd keep towards the back so that nobody could see it. And just, you know, I'd mix... I'd always have, like... I'd buy two six-packs, and I would kind of replenish one with the other so that that way... my mom wouldn't realize how much I was drinking. I hide the bottles all the way at the bottom of the trash, etc., etc. And so, yeah, so around this time, I really was going nowhere fast, and I kind of had this image of myself as being this, you know, it's like I wanted to be dead and famous by 27, and because that's like the Jimi Hendrix age, and Janis Joplin, and Jim Morrison, and really I was just this really... annoying asshole at the bars that was talking too loud, and I wasn't writing anything, and I wasn't playing anything, you know? But that's how it was in my mind, but I wasn't a poet, and, you know, I was barely whatever. I was just kind of a shell. And so I had a friend of mine who was also a musician, and we were working a job together. And it was like a piece of cake thing for anybody who's creative. It was like, show up when we wanted, we could leave when we wanted. We were just basically working on this house, and neither of us knew what we were doing. That was one of the gifts that he had, was he was like my enabling buddy who was also using. He would just lie to people about jobs. They'd be like, hey, I need someone to reframe the house. I'm like, I know how to do that. And he had no idea. So somehow or another, I got blood on me. I'd show up for like 2 hours a day, and I'd bill these people for like 8 hours, and so I had a situation where I had a show on like a Thursday or something like that. I went and I played it. I got done. And the party just continued through the weekend. And I never came home. And, you know, it's funny to say it now, but this is before people had cell phones, and dating myself there. and I was just, like, when we talk about going... on a run, like an alcohol run, I was on a run. I was driving all over the Pennsylvania area and going to this person to get that and going to that person to do this and going to that club and doing this, and it was a run. I mean, literally, I was running. And I had a situation where my car ran out of gas at the base of this bridge on like one of the first nights of this tear. And so after 3 or 4 days, I was like, well, I guess I better go get my car and head back home. And my car was missing, so I called home, and my mom answered the phone, and it was her and my sister and my girlfriend at the time, and they had basically thought I was dead, because my car was at the base of a bridge. I didn't show up for like 3 or 4 days, and so they just assumed I was dead, and so they had kind of started calling around my friends, putting word out that I'm missing and or dead. And just hearing their tears and hearing that anguish of and joy at the same time. And then I started to figure out, well, I got to go get my car. And I was calling my friends, and they're like, dude, what did you do? You know, like, as far as I knew, I had no friends, no family, nowhere to go, no music, no band. I had nothing, you know. So when I did get home, I called up the friend of mine that I was working with who had been sober at that point. And I knew that because he was dropping slogans. And I knew the slogans from when I was an Alateen, you know. And so I could see the change in him, you know. I could see, like he was actually, we were making really good hourly money. And it was all under the table. And he was, like, being smart about it. Like, wow, I'll actually show up early, you know, or at least on time. And could just see it in him. I'm like, why does this guy have his shit together, you know? And then he was dropping the slogans, and I was like, man, that's it. And so I started to talk to him about it a little bit. And so, you know, I was like, well, I knew a little bit, but, you know, I think that's where legal has a special place. It's like I knew about AA from my dad, and I couldn't identify with that group of people. They were adults, you know what I mean? And even though I was in my 20s, I wasn't an adult. I'll be honest, in a lot of ways, I still don't feel like I'm an adult. But I think that's also a gift of recovery, too, not taking ourselves so seriously all the time. But I didn't see anything in that world that I wanted, you know, and I knew that there was this big God thing in everything. So I said, so, man, you know, called him up. I'm like, so are we working on Monday? He's like, yeah. I'm like, yeah, 8 o'clock. He's like, yeah, you going to be in, like, around 11? I'm like, well, maybe, you know. Yeah, how's your band doing? All right, yeah, okay. Was that it? Yeah. And by the way, are you sober? And he's like, oh, is that what this is about? I said, yeah. And so we started talking, and he's like, you know, your higher power can be anything you want it to be. And so if you're new to the rooms, I'm a big believer in working the steps. But I also am a believer that it's a spiritual journey, and it's a spiritual practice. So it's a journey. That means that, like, you're not going to get there in one day. And it's a practice, which means it's something that you're going to keep going to. And I'm really thankful that AA is set up in such a way that our version of God can be whatever it wants to be. And that's cool because I still, you know, even as in the past year, I've tried going to structured church organizations, and I can't stand it, to be honest with you. That doesn't mean that I don't believe in God, though, because I very much do. It's just I don't know that I believe in churches or religions, but that's me. So I got done talking to him, and I'm like, I think this is it, you know? And this is kind of a funny story, and I won't be offended if you guys laugh, but my moment of clarity happened after I got off the phone with him, and I was watching The Simpsons, and there's this episode of The Simpsons where Bart sells his soul to Milhouse. And in that episode, like nobody wants to talk to him. Everybody's just kind of blanking him, you know. And I identified with that. I'm like, that's me, man. I don't have a soul, you know. And I remember I was like crying watching The Simpsons. But it was true. It was like you know, I was always maybe like Bart. You know, I was like always my mom's little guy. But like after that incident, I was not the little guy anymore. Like I was. The cat was out of the bag, you know? And same with my friends, too. Like, it's like I wasn't cute anymore, you know? It was old. And I had no soul. And so I went to my first meeting, and in Pennsylvania, man, it was like, I went to my first meeting, and it was in a church basement, and it was smoky, and I really hated it, and I left. But something stuck. And I just knew that I couldn't do it on my own. That if I was going to get sober, I needed help. So I went to another meeting, and I'll never forget. I can even see it in my eye, like I can see it in my head. I remember I walked into this meeting, and I was wearing skin-tight jeans and purple glitter Doc Martens, and I had blue and purple dreadlocks. And in Pennsylvania, you got to understand, you might as well have three eyes, you know. And I walked in, I looked at the back, and it looked like a field of cotton balls because it was all old people. You know? And I was like, shit. Alright. And I walked in and nobody even looked at me. Nobody like even turned their head or gave me a dirty look or anything. And it's like, wow, okay. That's pretty cool. And I got there late and I left early and I didn't say much to anybody, but there was one guy there who had this really cool way of speaking, and it ended up he was a radio DJ, and but he was an old guy, and he was like a fire and brimstone Baptist type guy, But I knew he had what I wanted, and I knew that I didn't know how to stay sober on my own, and I knew that he worked the steps, and I knew that, he had long-term sobriety, you know, and so he, I asked him to be my sponsor eventually, and that's what I loved about AA, was that there was no judgment there at all. And, you know, I gotta say, like, after a year, you know, I for the first year of sobriety, I said, I'm gonna put everything on the back burner. You know, like, everything else is to the side. Music's to the side, relationships, everything's to the side. That doesn't mean it's not there, it's just it's to the side, you know? So, but sobriety's the thing now, you know? Let me get a job where I show up and let me work a program with my sponsor. And that's what I did in my first year. And for me, I got all the cash and prizes. It was really funny, I spent all this time hiding in alcohol, trying to create this facade, and then when I got sober, it actually really happened. I was able to move to New York, and I got a career playing music, and that's still what I do. I play music, and I've done other things too. You know, in sobriety, I've gotten married and divorced. I've gone to school, which I never thought would happen. You know, I've had people die. I've experienced the saddest bottoms, but I think a lot of that's because I'm not numbing myself anymore. And so that's what happens when you feel it even more. So one thing it's really important for newcomers, because the first year a lot of weird shit can happen, and not all of it's going to be cotton candy, you know, but what happens is it changes the way you respond to these things. That's what happens in sobriety. I had a thing where I had a grandmom die when I was using, and I remember being at her funeral, and I had a bag of Coke in my pocket, and I didn't sleep the whole night before because I was partying. And I really regret that. And then when my grandmother passed away on the other side and I was sober, I was there, you know, holding the basin under her while she passed, you know. That's the difference in sobriety. You know, sobriety doesn't stop grandmoms from dying. You know, it stops, you know, changes how you respond to them. So I'm going to wrap it up here real quick, but I just wanted to say, you know, if you're new, keep coming. This meeting is great, and try and make as many friends as you can. It can be really hard. It's not always easy, but this is a great group of people here, and they'll stick their hand out to you and say, hey, and it might seem weird at first, but you know, shake their hand, get to know them, and you'll realize you're right. They are weird, but in very beautiful, beautiful ways, you know. And so that's all I have to say. You know, just keep coming back, and thank you to everybody who's here, who's been here for me over the past few years. So thank you.